Well, welcome to Week, the Commonwealth Club's Political Roundtable program for Monday, May 11th, 2015. Thanks for joining us here in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week, and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. This was the week in which we learned that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie had racked up more than $82,000 in bills for food and alcohol at MetLife Stadium over 2 years. So,
It doesn't show at all.
Right. So those $15 beers add up, I guess. But today, on today's program, we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the influx of presidential candidates coming hat in hand to Silicon Valley, plus some other news from the 2016 race, the latest plans for a U.S. military invasion that will come as a surprise even to the U.S. military, some police politics, political lessons from around the world, and more political news. So as usual, any opinions that are expressed up here are those only of the speakers, not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Carla Marinucci, a senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and she's on Twitter at @CMarinucci. Next to her and joining us for the first time is Mark Z. Baraback. He's a political writer for the Los Angeles Times. He's on Twitter at @MarkZBaraback. And next to me is Josh Richman, the state and national politics reporter for the Bay Area News Group, and his Twitter handle is Josh_Richmond. Now, Carla, Mark, and Josh were all included in a list, by the way, in the Washington Post The Fix column earlier this year, naming the 25 top political reporters across all the 50 states. So you've got a top-flight panel here tonight. I, unfortunately, can only bring down the quality of this program, so I hope you'll bear with me. I'll try to do my best. Now, please use the question cards, as we've already got a few here, to write down and submit any questions. I will try to ask as many as possible during our program. Now, on to our roundtable. Wanted to start with, where else at San Francisco? Let's talk politics and money. And Carla, Hillary Clinton, she was in town recently. She was not riding the Scooby bus, you might have heard, that she's driving through Iowa, doing kind of small groups. What was she doing in San Francisco?
Well, she was doing what I think we're going to be seeing her doing from now until 2016.
We're not actually seeing her.
We're not actually even seeing her doing that. And that is fundraising. And boy, this race, they say, what, $2.5 billion is the number they're
that
throwing
she needs
out.
To raise.
Yeah, the Koch brothers alone are trying to put together $900 million. So what happens? These folks come in. We don't get anywhere near them. None of you get anywhere near them unless you're willing to put up $2,700 to do so. Hillary's campaign is raising right now, just for the primary, $2,700 donations. She got a lot of people both here in two events in San Francisco and one in Portola Valley. And the one in Portola Valley, I got a call from somebody who was there. They said Hillary was on fire. She was amazing. She took questions from the audience. She talked about everything from, you know, foreign policy to teen suicide. A girl in the audience asked her a question about teen suicide. She was able to name chapter and verse on every program she'd ever worked with on teen suicide. People's eyes were welling up with tears, and I said, that's really great. Why wouldn't it have been great to have at least some media there to show what would happen? But we're not getting into these events. That's our big complaint, I think, in this panel.
Yeah.
This campaign, and it's not just Hillary Clinton, is being run out of the limelight, in the shadows, with the people who can pay big checks, and the media has no access to these events.
It's particularly a problem here in California, you know, where we're not an early primary state. We're not a state that's really in play in any way. So she's done some public events in other states, although even there it's not exactly anybody can walk up and ask her a question kind of situation. But here she has no reason to need to rally actual voters. She is here to get these contributions. And I think it's worth noting also that although each person there gave $2,700 to get in, the purpose of what they're calling this Hill Raisers program, Hill Raisers, is to turn each of these people into a bundler, essentially, so that you know, they pay $2,700 to go, but then they'll go out and collect $2,700 from each of 10 friends, family, or business associates and funnel that through. So, you know, there's a lot of money changing hands, and unless you have $2,700 you're willing to spend, you will not see her in probably do any public events here for quite a long time, if at all, unless there's some actual contest in the primary, which it's not looking like there's really going to be. I don't think you're going to see the kind of rallies you saw even in 2008 when Obama did a rally in Oakland, Hillary did a rally in Oakland, you know, where people could flock into the streets and
that's
see
right.
them and stuff. Not going to see that this time.
Yeah, Mark?
I was just going to say that was the February, I think that was the February primary when California was still in play. I mean, we were lumped together with like 14 other states or something. I think now we're back to June, so.
So, Mark, you've covered a lot of these campaigns. You've been out on national coverage. I mean, is this normal for candidates? Has this changed since you started?
Well, I think it is normal. I think what's changed is the order of magnitude. I mean, we're just talking, you know, it's interesting. There have been stories written about, you know, people who can only write checks for, you know, 10,000 or 100,000 or a million who are like, you know, they're not big players anymore. I mean, now candidates are talking about raising tens, if not hundreds of millions. So, I mean, I guess I'm a little more sanguine to the extent that I think it is still early. I mean, what the candidates do is they raise a ton of money so they can go out and spend it later on ads, which blessedly we won't see in here in California. I think eventually we're going to get around, just to digress for a second, to talk about the state Senate race out in, and as you suggested, I've been doing this for a long time. This is like my 10th presidential campaign. I have new sympathy for people who live in battleground states. I've talked to them over and over and over the years, and they kept saying, boy, I can't wait till the campaign's over for the TV ads to stop and the mail to stop. And as someone who lives out in SD, Senate District 7, I cannot wait for the mail to stop. I cannot wait for the I have new understanding and appreciation. So, you know, candidates have always been raising money. California has always, it's a cliche, we're the ATM, right? People come here and raise money that they can go spend in Iowa, New Hampshire, and those other states. I think what's really different is they're starting earlier. We could talk about the extent anyone cares. There's structural differences now in terms of super PACs, in terms of individual donors who can keep people going. You know, the only reason, as someone once, I think it was Bill Carrick, he's a consultant we all know once put it, the only reason people stop running for president is number one, if they die, or number two, if they run out of money. And these days, people can not run out of money. You had last time people like Rick Santorum, people like Newt Gingrich, who clearly were not going to win the nomination, but they had individual donors who were writing them big checks and kept them going. So that's changed, too.
Now, Hillary Clinton was not the only presidential candidate who was in the Bay Area. Rand Paul came out here.
That's right. And I think he does get some credit. I moderated a discussion with Rand Paul on Saturday in the South of Market, where he is actually setting up a shop in a tech incubator in the South of Market. It's actually a sketchy area of town, to be honest. I mean, it's right near the Chronicle and next to a bar behind the Chronicle.
Yeah, sketchy neighborhood.
That's why it's sketchy. But it's very unusual for a Republican candidate to be the first one to have some kind of real presence here in San Francisco is a little bit unusual. But also for him to come and sit before a bunch of voters. I mean, it's a concept, right?
How did his brand of kind of libertarian and Republican
conservatism I mean, I think it was interesting to watch because Rand Paul is not with the Silicon Valley crowd on a lot of issues. Net neutrality is one. He takes a completely opposite view on issues like same-sex marriage. I mean, my question to him was, look, how are you going to get these libertarian young tech voters when you have the same position as the rest of the Republican pack on same-sex marriage? And the answer essentially was, well, we'll have to agree to disagree on some issues. And I'm not sure that's going to fly with a lot of the Silicon Valley crowd. But the fact is, I think it's going to be a rare thing to see a candidate come to San Francisco and do that kind of event. And I think that's a good thing. He was aiming at the millennial voter group. And this is a group that in the 2014 election here in California, less than 9% of the eligible millennial voters, that is those 35 and under, less than 9% voted in the midterm election. I mean, I think the word out of UC Davis when they did a study was if you were 18, you were twice as likely to have been in prison than to have voted in the 2014 election. I mean, so this is the big challenge. How are you going to get these people to vote, the younger voters to vote? And I think that was one of Rand Paul's focuses when he came here, as well as some of these other groups. You've now got a lot of very big money people in tech, like Sean Parker, who was a president, co-founder of Facebook, now a billionaire here in San Francisco. He founded this group called Brigade, a political action kind of startup. There's other groups like that, but you're going to see a lot of this tech money. This is where this area is going to become a focus for a lot of candidates. A lot of tech money floating around, a lot of startups, and not only a lot of donors to campaigns, but a lot of people who want to get involved and put this startup money into efforts to shape what's happening in the political scene.
Should probably point out that one of the things that Rand Paul does get traction with in Silicon Valley, and which also explains his appeal to a lot of young voters, is that they love his stance against government surveillance programs. He's been a very outspoken critic of the NSA activities, of, you know, other surveillance programs. And I have never seen a Republican draw the kind of screaming, young, adoring, standing room only crowd in Berkeley at UC that he drew a year ago. It was like a full on pep rally, and you know they adore him for that. Very often, when some of these voters start hearing where he stands on certain other things, that fades a little bit. But that's buying him a lot of ground here in Silicon Valley. It's not to be underestimated.
Yeah, agree.
I'm just going to ask a question right from the audience because I want to get into some of the other candidates who have been running, and just recently. We've had, I think, pretty much everyone else in the country announce they were seeking the Republican Party nomination. So someone says, who is most likely to get this the Republican presidential nomination and why? It's going to be Ben Carson, right, Carla?
Ben Carson. Yeah, it is true that in the last couple of weeks we've seen some candidates on the Republican side get in that are going to make it so interesting. Ben Carson being one of them, a very gifted neurosurgeon, someone who had, I think, was one of the original surgeons who was able to separate conjoined twins. So very gifted on that front. But on the legal front, I mean, he made the comment, I think, last week that if the president did not agree with a decision of the Supreme Court, he could just ignore it. Yeah. You got that. You got Ted Cruz. There's some... And Ted Cruz just chose the former Republican Party chair here in California, Ron Nearing, as his California chair. That's going to be an interesting thing to watch. They have sort of compared the Republican field right now to kind of a clown car thing going on with everybody pouring out. Hillary is still there, and then Bernie Sanders, as we know, and he came and spoke to the Commonwealth Club. That is a guy who's been available also to the media. So. I think it's going to get lively.
Well, you know, if I can interject, I mean, you know, the clown car analogy, I've heard it used. I think this is a stronger and more substantive field than 4 years ago. I mean, you have a very large number, and I think I would associate myself with the suggestion that Ben Carson is not going to be the nominee. I don't think Carly Fiorina is going to be the nominee. I mean, there are candidates. Donald Trump is not going to be the nominee. Who knows if he's even running? But that said, you know, it is a large field, but I think there are people of substance who are running. And you can disagree with their philosophies, you can disagree, but, you know, the governor of Ohio, John Kasich, is likely to run. He's a serious and substantive politician. So is Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, obviously. I mean, there is always the fringy, crazy element. There's the people who are running basically just to up their profiles and land a show on Fox or boost their lecture fees. But I would say this is a serious, more substantive, and I would say even an interesting field. I mean, you look at someone like Rand Paul, who is taking positions not just on issues like drones and personal privacy, but, you know, here's someone who in the aftermath of the Ferguson riots was talking about the black incarceration rates. I mean, when's the last time you heard a Republican talk about those things? So it is an interesting field. I'm not going to make predictions. I'm smart enough to know that I'm not smart enough to know, but I think it is a real interesting field.
And I think Carly Fiorina is someone who's made it more interesting, too, just by being a woman in the field.
Well, and she's already been taking some solid stands and setting herself apart from the pack.
Yeah, right. She's someone we all know in California really well as the former CEO of HP. And, of course, now there's been a number of stories about how she ran HP and a lot of critical stories about her effects on that company, especially 30,000 layoffs. I mean, the story last week was that she, in running, forgot to buy her domain name, CarlyFiorina.org, and the person who bought it just put up 30,000 faces saying, here's 30,000 reasons why you don't want to vote for Carly Fiorina. She's been supposed to be a tech candidate, but she forgot to do that. But the fact is that she is a strong... She, Carson, and Mike Huckabee, who got in last week, I think all have one thing in common. They're all very strong communicators. Every one of them. And Huckabee became a talk show host after running the first time around, in part because, I mean, he was just very good on the stump. He's just good, a good person, one-on-one retail campaigner. And Carly Fiorina, we saw her here in the Senate race. She came in 10 points behind Barbara Boxer, but she was still a very good communicator for the Republican side, I thought. You don't agree, Josh? She's going.
Well, no, you know.
No, I mean, no, you don't think she's a strong candidate, or you don't think she's a good communicator?
Yes.
No, I mean, I don't want to talk smack about Carly Fiorina, but I will. You know, she outperformed Meg Whitman that year, but that's not saying much, because that was a truly terrible candidate, you know, in terms of communicating and other things. You know, I had somebody put Carly Fiorina to me, you know, positing that she's sort of the Silicon Valley presidential candidate 1.0, right? So this is going to work out the bugs. They're going to find somebody next time who has a record that really is more unimpeachable, you know, since basically she's running on her Silicon Valley business executive experience, and yet the jury is still out, to say the least, on whether she was that good of an executive, and ultimately she was forced out by her board, you know, for a variety of reasons, including a plummeting stock price and perhaps paying too much attention to the 2004 presidential campaign and not enough attention to her plummeting stock price. I think she'll provide an interesting counterpoint in terms of being from the business background, whatever you think of that background, in terms of being the only woman, apparently, in the Republican field among what is going to be a tremendous pack of men, you know, by the time the first debate rolls around in August. It's going to be a very striking contrast, probably, just to have her up there. I just don't see her going all that far, and I think she communicates well when not challenged. I think, you know, it can be a mile wide and an inch deep in some cases with her. So,
you know, certain candidates have their billionaire supporter behind them. Now, she's no pauper herself.
No.
But does she have big money backing behind her?
We don't exactly know.
No, I don't think.
No?
I'm not aware.
I'm not either. I you know, when you're looking at, for instance, all of these candidates have the challenge of Jeb Bush, who has dad's Rolodex and brother's Rolodex. And
both Jeb and Rand Paul are going to be romancing, you know, two different sides of Silicon Valley. Jeb's going to be going for the older, venture capital investor money class, and Rand Paul's going to be going for the newer generation of tech IPO millionaires and libertarian type people.
Exactly.
And it may not leave a whole lot of room for Fiorina. A super PAC had been formed, I think, in February to support her exploration of a campaign. It hasn't had to file any reports yet. And, of course, she just declared last week, so her committee hasn't had to file any reports yet. So it'll be a while before we know what kind of money's actually coming out for her.
Okay. Well, just a couple questions before we move on to our next topic. Mark, if Hillary does not make it, Willie Brown says Jerry Brown may run. Comment.
I am exceedingly skeptical of that, needless to say. I mean, I Willie Brown for a long time, well, I don't want to talk smack about Willie Brown. Willie Brown was very good and had tremendous sophistication in terms of Sacramento politics and the legislature and running that sort of stuff, having seen 20 years of predictions, some of which don't pan out. Let's just leave it at that. I mean, look, structurally, if Hillary Clinton doesn't run, I think Martin O'Malley, the governor of Maryland, is likely to run. I would see it much more likely. I mean, structurally, if you look at the way the primaries go, if Hillary were to fail, presumably it would be because she lost in Iowa or New Hampshire, at which point people would turn to an alternative. I don't see Jerry Brown, you know, riding to the rescue of the Democratic Party. I mean, it makes for a fun story and a great narrative, but, you know, I think Jerry Brown said something very telling in his State of the State speech, which was, in so many words, With I quote it, and I wish I could remember the exact words, but the gist of it was basically there's a lot of stuff that needs seeing through to completion. And I think Jerry Brown is at a point in his life and in a point in his career where, you know, he can be remembered one of two ways. He could be remembered as the guy who helped bring California back from the brink and really turned it around, or the guy who ran four times for president and lost. And I don't think he would want to go out. I think more than anything, would Jerry Brown want to be president? Absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind he would love to be president. Does he want to run and lose the fourth time and have his legacy be this stumbling, bumbling 70-year-old guy embarrassing himself on the national stage? I don't think so. So I think for that reason alone, Jerry Brown is not going to run for president and will never be president.
I think his wife, Ann, would probably kick his butt, too.
Yeah.
I think she wants to be on the campaign trail.
Yeah. So. He has said that it would be up to his senior advisor, and that's Ann.
The Brown family primary.
That's right.
Okay, well, another question. Given the amount of money going into political campaigns on both sides, does Citizens United really matter? You know, that was the law that opponents have claimed, you know, is bringing in just huge amounts of outside money, and obviously Democrats have worried.
I want to say something about money, because I think, and this, take it how you will, I think there's too much obsession with money and how much money is in there. You know, money is not in and itself dispositive, okay? Ask President John Connolly, ask President Howard Dean, ask President Phil Gramm, all of whom had more money than the people they were running against. You know, money is important, and I liken it to this. It's like, let's say you're going to go up to Lake Tahoe and go skiing. You need gas in the car to get to Lake Tahoe to get on the mountain, but once you're on the mountain, you know, you're either going to perform well or you're not. So yes, you need a certain degree of money to be viable, if you will, to compete, but money in and of itself is not determinative. So I think I'm not minimizing the important. I think there are a lot of things that, frankly, I think a lot of us should be somewhat appalled by. You know, these billionaire people who are calling candidates for these cattle calls or having private audiences. I mean, you know, that is somewhat averse to the idea of the way we like to think our democracy works, these command performances for billionaires. That said, when it comes to the actual competition and winning votes, money, the person with the most money doesn't win.
I think this time around we've got a whole different universe with these super PACs. Both, for instance, Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton have said they're going to sort of cooperate with these super PACs now, helping them to raise money, but in strategy. For instance, Hillary, I think, announced last week with her super PAC, she will appear at their events. She can't exactly ask money for money directly, but then she can leave the room and they can ask for the money. And the strategists and so forth. Bush has said he's going to use some of their strategists. Now these, it's a creeping influence that more and more, I mean, it's the money people that are running, that are pulling the strings behind
it. It is,
but
again, I come back to the notion that, you know, yes, money matters, but only to a degree. Only to a mm-hmm. point. You know, I mean, I agree with everything you're saying, and there's a lot of, I mean, it's just a joke. There was this thing where candidates would set up, not candidates, their consultants would set up, like, Twitter accounts, and you know, they would be like, to simplify, they're not supposed to have any sort of communication whatsoever. And some of this is sort of obvious. You know, you don't need to be a brain surgeon to figure if you're Jeb Bush, these are the kind of ads that Jeb Bush wants to run. They don't have to have those kind of communications, but what they would do is, you know, a pollster might send some tweet, which would be this obscure thing, would mean nothing to anybody else, but to the people on the inside of the pack would realize this is the latest polling numbers. This is what's, so there were these workarounds, if you will, to go around the laws that they can't communicate with each other. All that stuff is very troublesome, and don't get me wrong, I enunciated the concern about billionaires having special access, all that sort of stuff, but at the end of the day, like I said, I do not think money decides elections. I think it's going to be, you know, the two candidates are going to have full board campaigns. They're going to have a minimum of three debates where they're going to stand on stage and people are going to see how they perform. And I think at the end of the day, again, this election, there's going to be more money, a ridiculous amount of money spent by both sides. But at the end of the day, I do not believe the next president is going to be elected on the basis of how much he or she raises. That's just me.
How would you like a political story that has nothing to do with money, then? Shall we?
Yeah.
I've got one. This, in fact, is my favorite news story of the year. It's called Texas. It really sounds like an article from The Onion, but it's a real story. I can't really call it a true story. So there are some conspiracy theorists and militia types down in Texas, I should probably say down yonder in Texas, who think the United States is going to invade Texas. This has to do with what's called Jade Helm, a military exercise that is taking place in Texas and a few other states. And Josh, this would be nothing but forehead slapping funny if frankly, the governor of Texas hadn't given credence to some of this. So can you tell, tell us what's going on?
I hate to tell you this, but it has a lot to do with money.
Our next topic is...
Yeah. Sorry.
It always does.
No, you know...
What do you mean by that?
The governor basically directed the Texas State Guard to keep an eye on this whole military exercise to make sure it's not some prelude to an invasion. And, you know, some of the conspiracy theorists believe that there are tunnels being built beneath some closed Walmarts that'll be used as FEMA relocation / death camps. It's ridiculous, but it's infuriating, and here's why. I feel sorry for the people who actually believe this, because they are being taken for a ride, and they are being robbed of their money. They are being robbed of money by political committees that propagate and then profit from these ridiculous ideas, these ridiculous theories. You know, they'll get emails saying, you know, Texas is about to be invaded. Give now, you know. They're being soaked by this so-called prepper industry. There's a whole subculture out there for people who are preparing either for the end of days or for the coming civil war or the big racial uprising or whatever breakdown of civil society they think is about to happen. And there is an entire industry out there that is selling everything from food and clothing and you know, supplies and stuff to these people at ridiculously inflated prices. They're being taken to some extent by the gun industry, you know, who are convinced, have a lot of people convinced that the government is just about to come and take away everybody's guns, and the only way to stave off this impending tyranny is to buy 4 more AR-15 rifles, right? So, I mean, it is a culture of fear that is being propagated only for the reason of either selling somebody's books or selling somebody's disaster supplies or selling somebody's guns or selling something to someone. And the poor people who are being tricked into believing these forehead-slappingly dumb conspiracy theories are the ones who are suffering from it.
Well, and if I can append a thought and maybe give some political context to it, Texas is a one-party, very, very conservative state, as you all know. And I used to have these numbers in my head, and I don't, but the number of people who vote in a Texas primary is exceedingly small. And they are very, 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 very conservative. It is impossible to get too far to the right. Just to give you a like number, I mean, Texas is a state of like 25 or 27 million people or so. I don't know the exact numbers, but imagine in a state like California, if the only people who voted were maybe, state of 38 million people, California, if maybe 250,000 of the most extreme left-wing Californians voted. That's basically what you have in Texas. It is I think fewer than a million people in a state of 25 million actually vote in Republican primaries. So winning a Republican primary in Texas is tantamount to election, which is why you have candidates who will go and pander to these people on the very, very far right with these very, very extreme anti-government is what it comes down to. And Josh is absolutely right in terms of preying on the fears of people, but you know, you can never get too far to the right, and you can never say enough bad things about Washington in a Texas primary.
You know, and we should say, though, that this kind of sort of anti-government paranoia is not limited to the right, because John and I were looking it up before this event. The last time there was a major sort of freakout over this exercise was 1999 in Oakland, when Mayor Jerry Brown was faced by a bunch of people on the left thinking that the Marines were going to come in and do some kind of, right?
Yeah, but the governor didn't pander to them. You know, I mean,
it's one
thing to have a small group of extremists. It's another thing to have, you know, the machinery of state government basically saying, oh, yes, you know, we must be careful. It's
no, I completely agree. But the point is that There are conspiracy theorists on both sides of that.
To follow up on what Josh said, there's a Republican former state representative in Texas, Todd Smith, who sent a scathing letter to Governor Greg Abbott accusing him of, quote, pandering to idiots, unquote. He said he was, quote, horrified that I have to choose between the possibility that my governor actually believes this stuff and the possibility that my governor doesn't have the backbone to stand up to those who do. I'm assuming Jerry Brown didn't.
Yeah, he did stand up. He stood up to the, yeah. the right, exactly. It was a much different situation, but the fact is.
Let's put this in perspective. Yeah. Rick Perry said this is crazy, and Governor Brown. I'm serious. I mean. So why are we talking about this? It's Texas, and we're in California.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
why.
I'm sure they say the same things about us.
Well, actually, one of the areas that they think is being targeted by the military exercise is this supposed insurgent area in California.
Down by San Diego. That's the insurgent California. Yeah, right.
Okay. Just for the panel, I guess, the question, how many days before Governor Greg Abbott declares his candidacy for President of the United States? No? Okay. Well, let's move on then. We'll see if this has to do with money. Well, actually, it does. This is a bit more serious of a topic, and that is the issue of the policing in the country and various investigations now, and obviously, I mean, you all know the stories that have been happening in cities across the country, the protests, the reactions and such. Police behavior has become a topic that activists have kind of coalesced around to protest a collection of issues. Some might or might not be related. Police misbehavior, corruption, any income inequality is being thrown in there, militarization of police. So let's talk a bit about what's happening. I mean, stuff is happening both on the national level as well as right here in San Francisco. On the national level, the U.S. Justice Department announced an investigation into the Baltimore Police Department's methods in the wake of the death of this 25-year-old African-American man, Freddie Gray, who died while in police custody. And then here in San Francisco, the city's district attorney, George Gascon, has brought in three retired judges to look into issues of racism within the police department. So, Carla, as a political issue, do you think this is...
I think this is something that has been sort of transformative in the country. When you talk about names like Michael Brown, Oscar Grant, these are names that are now part of our history. We all know who they are, and I think that we sort of understand the Baltimore situation has raised the possibility. This isn't just about race, because in Baltimore, the arresting officers were African American. The police chief and many of the majority of the government, right? So it is about policing and how, and some of the questions raised with that. We've seen this in Oakland with problems like the rioters. We've seen and the Baltimore police chief was the Oakland police chief at one point. We've seen this in San Francisco with racist texts and situations in the jail where inmates were put to fighting each other. So I think that's part of the examination too. It isn't just about race; it's about the how policing is done and who it most affects in terms of some of our citizens who are least capable in fighting back in some cases. San Jose just announced today. I mean, they're doing an investigation into why a disproportionate number of Latinos and African Americans are arrested in that city when they only make up a third of the city population. They are a disproportionate number of the arrests. So, I mean, this is something that I think just raised our consciousness all over the country.
Well, and I think politically, and this is kind of hoity-toity, but I think we're sort of an interesting inflection point, if you will, because you have a convergence of people who are coming from the left who will note the disparity in sentencing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the huge number of African Americans who are in jail, way out of proportion to their population, and drug use and those sorts of things. So you have people coming at it from that side, and now you have people coming at it from the right, and in fact, people who, my Democratic and liberal friends think of as the devils incarnate, the Koch brothers, are actually putting money into a research project looking at disproportionate sentencing and how it's affecting the African-American community. And a lot of Republicans, Rand Paul, others, are coming from the point of view, this is an enormous waste, in their words, expenditure of public funds, and saying, you know, I mean, those of us who've been in California for a long time remember under Governor Duke Majin, remember it was bill prisons, and there was this whole wave that swept the country during the 80s, tough on crime and sentencing and crack and all that sort of stuff, to a point where the prison population has ballooned, and with it, public spending. So again, you have people on the left coming at it from one way, sort of more of a call it what you will, the rightness, the morality of jailing all these people, and you have people on the right coming at it from a fiscal point of view and meeting in the middle. And so again, going back to the whole inflection point, we're at a point where there is that consensus, and I think we're likely to see some changes in the next few years.
You agree, Josh? I mean, are there any standard bearers for this as an issue in the political world?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, like Mark said before, you see Rand Paul talking about, over-incarceration, disproportionate incarceration of minorities, militarization of civilian police forces, rampant prison industrial complex. We've seen it here in California very distinctly with, you know, the panel of federal appellate judges who ordered that the prison population be decreased. We saw a very compelling argument get made for abolition of the death penalty recently. Didn't quite take, but for the first time you had conservatives arguing that it just makes no fiscal sense whatsoever to pursue the death penalty because it takes forever to get through the appeals process. You're spending way more on trying unsuccessfully to put an inmate to death than you would spend to, you know, keep several inmates in prison for the rest of their lives. So wherever they're coming at it, Mark's right, you know, people are meeting in the middle on this, and I think there is an opportunity here for reformers who have been sort of been crying in the wilderness for a long time to finally get some support from both their flanks and maybe move forward. In terms of the recent protests and stuff, you know, it's a very emotionally charged topic, isn't it? You know, it has, you know, when you talk about the militarization of our inner cities, you're talking about job opportunity and education and income disparities and all kinds of stuff like that. And you'll find that some candidates are more willing to delve into that level of it than others. You know, you've got a Bernie Sanders out there who'll talk about that until you just, you know, until your eyes roll back in your head, and he's been trying to talk about it for years, but not that many people were listening. It'll be interesting to see if a Jeb Bush or a Scott Walker makes a compelling case for any of that stuff. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, let's move on then. I want to put a bit of an international angle in this, and that is, if you follow the international news, you saw recently pollsters and analysts recently expected a very close race in the Israeli race for leadership, right up till the end, except that it was won resoundingly by the conservative incumbent. In the United Kingdom, just this past weekend, Thursday or Friday, I think, pollsters and analysts, again, expected a very close race in the UK race election, and it was won resoundingly by the conservative incumbent. So I just kind of wanted to look, is this something, I mean, during the 2012 presidential election, you had certain conservative activists who were talking about unskewing the polls. They thought conservative voters were being underrepresented, and therefore, if the polling was actually accurate, then it would show much more support for the Republican candidate. Didn't turn out that way, but any thoughts on UK, Israel? Are these one-offs, or are these, is there, you know, uncounted, what's the word, silent majority in the U.S.?
I don't think there's a conservative wave sweeping the world necessarily. I mean, you see anti-austerity protests in Greece and lots of other places at the same time. But, you know, the Israeli election, I don't know as much about the U.K. election, but the Israeli election, a lot of the criticisms, especially in the final weeks of that campaign, is that Netanyahu retained power through a very fear-oriented campaign, you know, that he became sort of presented himself successfully as sort of a bulwark against this impending doom that the state of Israel faces. And whether or not it does is not my point. You know, I think fear can be a very potent
motivator for voters. And everything comes down to who actually votes. If everybody in this country voted, everybody who was of age and eligible to do so, you would have a vastly different electorate. But the fact is, even in a presidential year, when we talk about the big turnout, it's not that great a turnout very often, you know. And in off years, we just had the worst turnout that our state had ever seen in this past gubernatorial election. So it was a travesty. So what motivates people to vote? You know, do people vote because they feel it's their civic duty? Do they vote because they think they have a personal vested interest in it? Do they vote because they are afraid of something, because they want something?
I'm afraid that the United States is going to invade California.
Well, you know, exactly, right? So, you know, it comes back to what we were talking about with Texas.
Sure.
What is it that gets under people's skin and makes them actually give money to a political committee or fill out a ballot and mail it in or go to a polling place? Unfortunately, in a lot of places at a lot of times, whether it's economic fear or a physical well-being fear or whatever, it's fear.
And I think with the UK election, I think a lot of people looked at it and said, what does it mean? What does the future of the Conservatives there mean to the future of the Republican Party here? I think we've seen sort of a diminished Conservative movement in Britain from the time David Cameron swept into now. And they're facing a lot of problems that, you know, what's going to happen with the Scottish independent movement? What's going to happen with the future with the EU? Terrorism. Just like the Republicans here, David Cameron and his party have to deal with a lot of splinter issues.
Sure.
and splintering of the party. And I think we're going to watch that play out. But there was no great victory for conservatives in the sense of that any Republicans here could rejoice or find some overarching reason why they're going to come out successful in 2016 because of that election.
Mark?
Hold me to 60 seconds, because I could go on at length about this. I have a huge bug up my rear end when it comes to polls, and I'm going to state that up front. I hate polls. I would paraphrase Shakespeare by saying, first kill all the pollsters, and some of my best friends are pollsters. I hate what polling has done to my business. I think it's insidious. I think that the very best poll, and most people don't appreciate that, is mere guesswork. I think there is too much emphasis that is done on polling. I think the quality of polling has diminished. We see it in my industry. A good poll costs a lot of money. Most media outlets do not pay good money, so you have a bunch of crappy polls. And it's very easy for a reporter to write a poll story. It's very hard and expensive for a reporter to go someplace and really dig on a subject. And those of you familiar with Gresham's Law, it's the political equivalent of Gresham's Law. It's bad information chasing out good. If I ran the world, I would first ban all the pollsters.
There goes Mark playing to the crowd yet again.
I poll tested that response. Before I came in here, I did a poll focus group.
Your favorite
group.
Focus group.
Exactly.
Not
yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a few other things. Let's talk about how this. If you're about to fall asleep, you might want to pinch yourself, because when I tell you there's a state Senate district election, you're already starting to, you know, eyes are getting glazed, yeah. But this one is really interesting. Carla, tell us about the 7th Senate District. It's over in East Bay.
Well, this one is like a demolition derby. This is a knockdown drag. This is a WWF fight. This is a...
It's an abomination.
It's got the Koch brothers. It's got Tom Steyer. It's got
millions of big money coming
dollars.
Into it.
Basically, it's two Democrats killing each other off here. This is the East Bay race, and that's why it's being watched all around the state, and maybe in other parts of the country, because it's a test of our top two primary system, which a lot of people in the rest of the country call the jungle primary. You got two Democrats who are sort of really not that far from each other on some issues, but Steve Glazer is the sort of moderate candidate, the mayor of Orinda. People like him, and he has expressed a definitive opinion that there should be no more BART strikes, that BART strikes should be outlawed, or BART unions should not be allowed to strike. That has won him the complete enmity of every public employees union, and they're pouring millions of dollars into Susan Bonilla. She's the assembly candidate, assemblywoman who's running, and this is all to replace Mark DeSantis, who's ascended to Congress, to the House of Representatives. So Right now, you got these two Democrats, and the amount of money coming in from the outside is just insane. And I think it shows a couple of things. We'll get back to money, but the effects of this top two primary is really very interesting. To see the kind of ammunition being thrown back and forth that the Democrats are throwing back and forth at each other, right?
Mark, how many mailers a day are you getting?
Oh, I would say between 5 and 10.
A day.
Yeah, and I get about 6 phone calls a day,
yeah.
And I've had a couple door knockers over the weekend. It really is crazy. And I think Carla makes a really good point. I think the reason there is so much money being spent because I think people really think the stakes are very, very high. I think people are going to look at this election and say, if Steve Glazer wins, they're going to say, okay, you know what? If you are a moderate to centrist Democrat, under this top two thing, you can run and you can win. And I think if he loses, a lot of people are going to say, wow, look at Steve Glazer. I'm just not going to bother because clearly it doesn't work. So the reason so much money is being spent, ridiculous, inordinate amounts of money, wasted amounts of money. I mean, I will tell you, I literally pick the stuff up. I have one of those mail slots that goes in the garage. I walk 10 feet and drop into the recycle without even looking. But the reason all this money is being spent is because the stakes are very, very, very high.
Yeah. It's an absolute abomination. We're talking like $7 million in independent expenditures coming in from outside the campaigns to pay for all of these mailers and these TV ads and radio ads and what have you. And it's absolutely disgusting. People are getting sick of it. The interesting thing that I think is that I'm not convinced the stakes are that high at all.
Really?
You know? Yeah, because one of the reasons that Glazer, one of these two candidates, the more moderate one, who Bonilla would be quick to tell you is not really a Democrat, one of the reasons he got blacklisted by the unions in the first place is that he's a political consultant and he had done some work on behalf of Jobs PAC, the California Chamber of Commerce Political Action Committee, to help a couple of business-friendly Democrats defeat some more labor-friendly Democrats in the 2012 elections. Well, Glazer wasn't around for the end game of that campaign, but ultimately those Democrats won, you know, the two that he had done some work for over that summer. And don't you know, they both went to Sacramento, and this past year they both got 97% scorecard ratings from the California Labor Federation, which endorsed them for re-election, along with the California Democratic Party. And so, you know, it was going to be gloom and doom and horror, supposedly, as far as the unions and parts of the Democratic Party were concerned, if these people actually got in instead of the favored labor Democrats. And yet when they went to Sacramento on all but one or two votes, they voted the party and labor line. So I'm not sure that Steve Glazer necessarily would to the extent that these other guys did. I think he may be a sort of a different case. But, you know, there's a whole different set of pressures that come to bear when you're on the campaign trail and then when you're actually in office and trying to get consensus on your bills and trying to build relationships with other lawmakers. He could end up voting against the party all the time, in which case he'll get nothing passed and he'll probably be out of office in a couple of years.
See, and where I think we disagree, and I want to clarify in case there's any doubt, I'm a political hack. I don't do policy. So I'm thinking of this less from the policy perspective than if people are sitting down the end of this year or next year in terms of thinking of running and funding campaigns. I don't know how it's going to change policy so much as, like I said, I think if people are looking to run and they're going to say, look at Steve Glazer, he ran, he got carpet bombed, you know, forget it, I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to fund that kind of I think of it more in terms of the kind of candidates who run and who would be viable.
Well, I mean, we saw that to some extent, you know, not as ugly, not with as much outside spending, but with the Mike Honda-Ro Khanna race, another Democrat on Democrat race in the 17th congressional district last year in the South Bay, where Mike Honda, the longtime incumbent, is an old school union friendly Democrat. Ro Khanna came in with trying to be more of a voice of Silicon Valley business, and of course was painted by Mike Honda and his allies, you know, who were spending on his behalf to some extent as being a Democrat in name only and a closet Republican and this and that. Khanna lost, but he's coming back.
He's running again.
He raised $800,000 in 1 month in the first quarter of this year for next year's campaign. He just lost in November,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
By, what was it, 3.6 percentage points or something like that?
Yeah.
He came close. But Mike Honda, at the end of February, had the misfortune of maybe dozing off a little bit on C-SPAN during a Homeland Security debate on the House floor. And suddenly, Ro Khanna's phone was ringing off the hook because all the people who funded his campaign last time are ready to go again. So I'm not convinced that a defeat, that was a close defeat, but I'm not convinced that a defeat actually dissuades people from spending their money on races like this.
I think there's just one more interesting thing about this race, and that is Steve Glaser has been sort of an advisor to Jerry Brown for, what, 2 decades?
Yeah. Long time.
I mean, he helped him win the election against Meg Whitman. He was
Whitman helped too.
Meg Whitman helped too, but but Steve was sort of the architect of that campaign. He's been a sort of an unpaid advisor pretty much to Jerry Brown for years. And yet Jerry Brown has not weighed in on this race.
Really?
And it's so interesting. What does it say about
get a dog?
If you want loyalty, get a dog. I guess that's it. In politics, there's no such thing, I guess, because Jerry Brown is between the unions and somebody he's known for a long time, has worked for him for a long time, and he's just not saying a thing. And I think that's a fascinating commentary on Jerry Brown and on the race, in a way.
Mark, someone supports you. They say the worst part is that polls lead the electorate. They should be illegal leading into elections. Some countries actually do ban them the last day or so.
Yeah, they do. Look, I mean, I want to be clear. I think polls are a good and useful tool. I think exit polls are very, very helpful. I just think, again, I think there's just too much attention given to them. And they just tend to drive the debate more than they should.
Particularly at this point, when they're
meaningless. Well, exactly. I mean, come on, give me a point. Okay, so Scott Walker is leading. First of all, people who report polls, they'll say Scott Walker is leading because he has 13% in the polls compared to Marco Rubio. Well, no, anyone who understands polling appreciates that with a margin of error of plus or minus, you know, Marco Rubio could have 16 and Scott Walker could have 9. So, again, there's this false precision that is assigned to polling because it's a number. He has 13.2%. And, you know, again, it's just this insidious factor that I think it really had an ill effect on our elections and our politics.
Okay. We've been talking about money in politics for so long. Let's just talk about the economy. There were good job numbers last week that came out for April. Is it obvious enough this helps Obama and Hillary, or is there any other angle that anyone can put on that?
Isn't this the biggest challenge that the Republicans have? Hillary's going to be able to say, everything was in the tank when we came into office. Obama improved it. What's your comeback?
Although, you know, the economy, you know, the numbers are good and the unemployment numbers are good, but there still is a huge amount of anxiety and a huge amount of unsettlement and a great deal of inequality. And I think that gives Republicans an opening. And the debate is going to be over how you address it. I mean, I think we all agree inequality is going to be a very huge subject of discussion in 2016. It's how you address that. So I agree with you, you know, and you can picture the ads now, you know, when Obama took office, unemployment was this, and now, you know, you can see those numbers. But underlying those numbers is a tremendous amount of unsettlement and anxiety. And I think that's going to be very much at the core of the presidential campaign.
Okay, well, let's get to some more questions here before we do our news quiz. Hillary Clinton indicated that she would go even further than President Obama on immigration with regard to executive action. Will that help or hurt her campaign?
Well, Mark, you were in, he was in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I was there when she did. I think it helps her campaign a great deal. I mean, I had a piece yesterday that talked about the Latino vote being hugely important in a number of states for a number of candidates. I mean, I think it helps Hillary Clinton a lot. In a nutshell, and put an asterisk by this, Hillary or any Democrat, you know, Hillary or any Democrat's going to be elected president in 2016. They need to reassemble the Obama coalition, which is millennials, young people, women, in particular single women, African Americans and Latinos. And I think as we sit here today, it is more likely than not that Hillary will get a majority of all those voter groups, but it's not enough to get a majority. She needs to get a very, very robust turnout. I'll give you one case in point. Nevada. Nevada has gone from a very Republican state to a purplish blue tinge state. Why? Because of Latino voters. Last year, Latino voters weren't excited. They stayed home in Nevada. What happened? For the first time ever, Republicans won every statewide office in Nevada. They defeated a guy who never should have been defeated in the Las Vegas House seat, and they took full control of the legislature in Carson City for the first time since 1929. Mm-hmm. So the point being, Hillary needs not just, or any Democrat, it's not just a to match Obama's numbers, but it has to be a very robust turnout, and I think she helped herself a lot with Latino voters with what she did last week in Las Vegas.
Yeah,
Carla, you were talking about Hillary Clinton not holding public events. The only people who got to hear what she had to say were people who paid $2,700. By the way, has anyone ever here paid like $2,500 or more to hear a politician? Anyone? No one? Okay.
Would anybody, if they could?
Tickets sound like $3,000.
$3,000?
Did you get in here? No.
Well, so this person asks, is it true that $2,700 is too much money for your news organization to afford to get you access into that meeting?
To get us in.
Yeah, we don't.
We won't pay.
We can't give money to candidates.
That means yes. Yeah. Okay.
And we're cheap. Also.
Is the 2016 election a personality contest, or are there overriding issues for this nation? Anybody? I think we're, is
the
it right now?
Personality contest? Is it
yeah. What do you think? What do you think? Maybe it primarily comes down to when people make their decisions.
You know, what I'm worried about is that more and more with this, with cable and the coverage. I hate to say the coverage is all about personality. She went to Chipotle. She didn't tip. She parked in the handicap space. She actually drove people to the Iowa event instead of just finding them there. What is she wearing today? That kind of coverage, and it's just not on the Hillary campaign. It's on all. It's focused a lot of times on the minutia and crazy personality-driven aspects of the campaign. Don't you agree?
I agree and I disagree. I agree with you that a lot of that stuff is trivial and stupid. I think a vote for president is unlike any other because people do feel like they get to know these people in a way we don't get to know other candidates so much. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think a vote for president very much is a vote for trust in a person because, as we all know, ISIS didn't exist when Obama took office. The Great Recession hadn't happened when Bush, so we don't know. So I think a lot of it for people, and, personality makes it sound like you said Chipotle and all that stupid stuff, but I think on a certain level, people basically are putting their faith in someone, and I trust this person, I feel good about them, I think that they can do a good job, whatever comes down the pike. So it's going to be a combination of things. It's going to be, there are certain people who can check the box on certain issues, but at the end of the day, I think it comes down to, do I trust this person and think they can do a good job?
Okay. Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, has said that W. Bush, his brother, is an authority he consults on the Middle East. He actually answered a question, this was the question I put out there in the other room, where he was asked if, on Fox News, would he vote to authorize the invasion of Iraq even knowing what we know now? In other words, about weapons of mass destruction.
Well, he didn't actually answer that question. What he answered was did he think it was the right decision at the time? He said, Hillary voted for it and other senators voted for it and such and such.
But he was asked, knowing what he knows now.
That was what he asked. That's not what he answered.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
So, well, he did a little deft footwork to get around that.
The politician trick, yeah.
Yeah. Well, did you see Laura Ingraham? Am I pronouncing her name right?
Yeah.
She's a very conservative radio host. She went after Jeb Bush and saying, no, Hillary Clinton would not. She voted for her back then, knowing what she knew back then. She wouldn't do that now. She had pretty harsh words for him. So that might...
I think that headline about Jeb bringing on his brother as an advisor is just a killer. Nothing's a total killer, but I think it's going to give a lot of voters pause. He has been insisting, I am my own man. And George Bush recently came and spoke to Sheldon Adelson primary out there in Las Vegas, another thing media was not allowed to cover. And he's really taking a backseat in this campaign for a reason. The association with him is just devastating, I think. So we'll see if we hear any more of George W., but I think Jeb is not going to make that mistake again.
Okay. Can a middle-class person run for president?
Sure.
Yeah.
They'll lose, but they can run. Well, anybody, Carla can run.
Will
you
see
can run.
You.
Yeah.
You
know, anybody, yeah, go ahead, run.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, again, it goes back to the money thing. Again, money is not dispositive. It does not decide elections, but you do need a certain table stake, if you will, to be viable. That's the sad
thing. Rand Paul called himself middle class last week. His net worth is, I think they said $1.3 million. Middle class?
Actually, Marco Rubio, I think if you were to net it out, is his net worth is probably in the hundreds of thousands. So, you know, by San Francisco standards, that's poor.
Yeah, and you know, and Carly Fiorina was a secretary at one point. You know, she got a great payout from HP. But the fact is, wasn't born into tons of money, so...
Scott Walker also has, there have been stories that he's, you know,
and didn't finish college.
Tens of thousands of dollars in credit card debt, which I think actually probably made a lot of folks say, you know, okay, I'm like that.
Right. Fiscal conservative.
Well, and Obama will point out, up until very recently, it was only when he wrote his book when he was a senator that he and Michelle Obama paid off all their college debts. So that would have been 2007 or so. Mm-hmm.
See, we started off talking about money. We wrapped up. Let's do a news quiz. We'll see if any of these are about money. So if... Colette can come up here. She's going to, for those of you who don't know how we do this, I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, please raise your hand. I'll call on you, and then you can shout it out. If you shout it out before then, it's a free-for-all. It's too messy. And if you get it right, then Colette will deliver some good Ghirardelli chocolate to you. So, the first question, inspired by the death of Freddie Gray, singer Prince has written a protest song called what? And I saw your hand right away.
Baltimore,
that's correct.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Fast.
The U.S. Senate voted 98-1 to give Congress the power to review and approve, yes, this isn't going where you think it's going, to review and approve or reject any treaty with Iran. Who was the one vote against it? And, sir, I saw your hand first.
Tom Cotton,
that is correct. I thought that might be a tougher one. Tom Cotton, by the way, is the guy who led the effort to write this, you know, to become pen pals with Iran. Okay. What high-profile Democrat cut short a trip to Guyana this week over health issues? I'm going to go with you first.
Jimmy Carter.
That's right. Former President Jimmy Carter. After meeting with Pope Francis, who said he was so impressed by the pontiff... You know where I'm going, that he's going to return to the Catholic Church. Sir?
Raul Castro.
That's right. Cuba President Raul Castro. Okay, let's see. Who criticized Senator Elizabeth Warren by noting that she is a politician like everybody else? And ma'am, I saw you. Sorry?
Obama.
President Obama, that's correct. Their sniping continues. Here's one you might not have seen. What did an 8-year-old boy find in the office bathroom of House Speaker John Boehner?
God.
I know, the mind boggles all the different...
yeah, right.
Sir? Sorry? That's right, a gun. A loaded Glock handgun. Okay. A few more. What country declared that its Ebola epidemic is over? Way in the back... Yes, I'm sorry, you're right. Okay. Yesterday, President Obama made surprise phone calls to whom? And I saw your hand first.
Mothers.
That's right, three mothers who had written into him. I have to keep track, otherwise I give away too much chocolate. That would be a tragedy, wouldn't it? Wednesday saw the death of what former Speaker of the House of Representatives?
Jim Wright,
that's correct. Former Texas Democrat, back when there were Texas Democrats. And our final question, though you could say this comes back to money as well. Who is Charlotte Elizabeth Diana?
Oh, come
Ma'am
on,
in the blue?
That's easy.
That is correct. She's the princess, the daughter of two rich people in the UK. I'm sorry, you would have been very close. Well, listen, we'll have more news quiz questions and, of course, a lot more to discuss on Monday, June 8th, at our next week-to-week program here at the Commonwealth Club. Thanks to our panel, Carla Marinucci, Mark Z. Baraback, and Josh Richmond. Thanks to all of you here watching us online and listening to us on TV. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.